We're living at such a unique time right now where you're getting real-time data, real-time feedback on everything you're putting out.
It's kind of a paradox when you see brands. They are always looking for content that is curated and perfect.
You have to know what your relationship with social media is.
What if tomorrow it shuts down? Like Instagram goes away.
That's it.
There is this constant pressure to create content which performs.
Most of the content we all consume is biased.
You just have to understand that people aren't going to websites in the way they are before.
True.
You need to have someone who's kind of has a view of what a brand should be with all these diverse pieces of content.
Welcome back to the next episode of the No BSness podcast. We are on this mission to remove the BSness from business. And we are going to do this by getting the best of the entrepreneurs from different business fields and how they have disrupted existing models and have created spaces and businesses of their own. In this episode, we will be talking to change makers, globally acclaimed content creators who have created successful new age media models in the Middle East and perhaps are looking to scale that in the rest of the part of the world. Let's talk to them. Let's hear their stories. Let's hear the goods and the bads. Watch our videos and become part of the movement. Some of the brightest creators, entrepreneurs in new age media who have decided to join us today. Richard, founder of Love in Dubai, Love in Saudi, Love in Beirut, Cairo, Smashy, and now Odium. I've got Dhruv with me, renowned creator, founder of Gulf Bus, Upton, globally renowned face and the founder of Upton Media. Do you break it? You own it. This was the magic of a line which Nike came up with when Caitlin Clark broke the all-time scoring record in basketball. Do you see the process of breaking something essential to own something, Upton? Or is it just that we're a product of our times and it's not about creating something new, but we're just following what generation wants us to do?
We're living at such a unique time right now where you're getting real-time data, real-time feedback on everything you're putting out. And we're so lucky in that sense. If you launched, like, let's say a watch brand, it could take you years to create, to manufacture, to go to market, only to find out people don't want to buy your watch. But when it comes to content, I can post something today and know exactly the feedback. I know exactly what percentage people are watching, who's watching. And if it's doing well, I can double down on that. If it's not doing well, I stop.
It's a simple sort of a process to it. Richard, do you think legacy media doesn't get it? Or they get it, but they don't want to break it? What's stopping them?
Facebook had a mantra of if it doesn't ship, it doesn't exist, or move fast and break things. And then when they broke society, they had to change their mantra to like move something with sustainable growth. But I think that is remains true. And, you know, we all look at what Elon Musk, when he drops a new website domain that's half broken or doesn't have any content on it, you know, global brand marketers, especially in the automotive sector, would freak out at that. Imagine Mercedes leaving a flash microsite or website out for a new automotive launch, model launch that isn't gone through the rigors of complete perfection, because that's what they're ingrained to do. That's the raison d'etre of a marketer. Like, that's what they're there to do, to check and to proof and to copy. And who approved the copy? You know, all this sort of stuff. But as Upton said, like, I think we are in an era of testing things. And I think it is very much a dynamic two-way. I think people who embrace the ethos of social media, that web 2.0, that feedback loop, will do well. And I think content, you have to be the same, right? Like, I actually think modern media companies like us and people here chatting, I think we're better at it than legacy media, but I also think we're kind of better at it than influencers. Like, I think influencers are really good at getting data and knowing what works, knowing what format works for them. But I think sometimes they protect their image because it's personal, and they, you know, they don't speak out about things and they delete things and they stay quiet. And if something hasn't gone their way, they can take that one down and try the one that works, right? Yeah. But in modern media companies, you know, we're up there and we're being attacked, and we don't delete stuff. Right. If there's a typo in a copy, we don't delete it. We embrace it. Yeah. We say sorry, and it's ephemeral anyway.
Speaking of influencers and someone who's been an influencer and has sort of metamorphosed into a business, yeah. Dhruv, what do you think of what Richard says in terms of influencers perhaps are not as close to communities and what they're thinking, their media habits, as compared to new age media businesses which you've created?
I completely agree with Richard, because when I started as an influencer before a media company was set up, and I used to delete stuff back in the day when it used to not go my way. As and when I evolved, I had a team, and then when people started coming to us and started telling us, oh, we like this, we like that, it's not necessarily important that you're reaching to everyone, but when you're putting out something, you're putting out for the masses in the end of the day. So it might help out someone on the other. As Richard clearly said that, you know, we get more attacked at some points, but that doesn't mean we're deleting it. It's because we need to put that out.
It's kind of a paradox, isn't it, Richard? Like when you see brands, they are always looking for content which is curated and perfect.
Yeah.
And what works is on these platforms is exactly the opposite. What works is being authentic and being imperfect.
Yeah.
Do you see that as a complete sort of a contradiction? How do you sort of navigate that with brands? And when you sort of have to break it out to them and say, hey, this is going to be imperfect, but it's going to work for you.
Yeah, I think Upton's a really good example of being authentic as a journalist who became a creator and who does media. But like I spoke about this at the Brand Me Summit last week. I think you have to know what your relationship with social media is. Is it your business or is it marketing? And brands aren't publishers. They're not. They're marketers. They're not actually publishers on social media. And they're not actually like a publisher is selling content either through ads, through a value exchange of time, or through subscription or any other means or merchandise or whatever your business model is.
Yeah.
So the relationship is different. A marketer is selling something else and using social media in a different way.
Right.
So and people who tell brands that they need to be publishers fundamentally don't know what they're talking about, because you can only say that if you really know the unit economics of that business and know the costs of content across platforms and whether that works. There are some brands like Red Bull who are exception to the rule, but generally, I don't think brands are publishers. So I don't think brands need to be as authentic and as true and get comments like dealing with community management and hate speech in their feed. And I don't think they need to do what publishers do and what journalists do in social media. I think it should be a different social media strategy.
I would actually push back on that, because I think if ultimately your job as a brand is to get eyeballs and get people to buy your product, how are you going to do that other than make interesting content, right? Unless, like you said, you're a Red Bull, you know, maybe Nike, the ones that have huge brand loyalty, fine. They already have this like inherent advantage. But I see so many of their companies, most of them are clients, that need to like break free from the noise. They come to us because all they know how to do is make like marketing material, which tend to be very polished ads on their Instagram feed, on their TikTok feed, on their Facebook feed. So they come to us, and then what we do is we give them faces, we give them creators. We literally give them content that is like shot on an iPhone in selfie mode that are going on big brand accounts throughout, you know, the UAE, government accounts too, because that's more effective. And so to your point about, you know, kind of being more unpolished, there's actually a term. It's called amateur by design. Mm. Even if I have nice DSLRs, even though I have, you know, lighting guys and production guys, I'm going to make it amateur, because amateur is what's relatable. Think about the end customer or the end viewer on the other side of an Instagram feed. When they're scrolling, they're constantly looking, how do I avoid an ad or a company, right? Ad or company swipe, ad or company swipe. The more that it's like going to be valuable to them, or the more faces they're going to see, the more they're going to believe like, hey, this is someone just like me. This is relatable. I want to see what this person has to say.
I'm glad you pushed back. And it is something you're providing clients, so I'd expect you to. And I agree. And I'm not going to sit here and say relatable content doesn't work for brands. It does. But there's reasons why Nike shut down a load of social media accounts. I know you use them as an example, but like marketing still works. Like, good ads and good content, it's the frequency side of things. Like how many published posts do you need to do a day, right? As a publisher, as a brand.
Right.
And if you're Nike or if you're any brands, right? Like how many do you need to do, you know, and what's the way to do it, right? And the cost of doing that. You know, if I was launching a digital digital vertical brands for like skincare, right? I'm not sure how much of a publisher I would be. I know there's the Huda Beauties of the world.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how much I would do. I don't know if I would do 50 a day or whatever. Like, I get there's people very successful at it, but I think I would find the right balance to it.
I think it kind of comes back to sometimes being a publisher is all about factors which may not be related to the actual content creation. Like, for example, I think when you look at how commercial agreements are drawn up between brands and content creators and perhaps even agencies, I don't think they are set out to make brands publishers, right? Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, for example, you guys are amazing, talented creators. How many pieces of content could brands push out with more content creators? That's not a scalable aspect as well. So there are limitations from a point of commercial agreements with brands. I think they're learning that, perhaps trying to be more flexible in trying to do that five pieces of content which could absolutely create that potential virality for them, because that requires a lot more than just production.
Yeah.
At the same time, content creators, right? How many agencies today, or let's say how many people who are working for brands can claim that each piece with a person going out is actually going to be creating the same amount of interest that, let's say, an Upton video is. So it's just a mix of things which may not directly be related to content creation.
It's a quite interesting social media strategy discussion.
Right.
You know, and I think, what era are we in? We're actually in an AI era. It's 2024, mm-hmm. right? And the content calendar, that Excel sheet with 20, 30 posts a month that social media agencies commoditize yeah. with the image and the copy and English and Arabic and the hashtags, it's to schedule the posts, don't engage with comments. Like, that era is kind of over. And I think the era that Upton is, and your agency are doing is you know, doing those sort of RFP and tenders about vertical videos and doing maybe 4 or 5 or 10 a month and doing them tactical around nice pieces, maybe, you know, for Ramadan or for things like that. I think that's the era that we're in now. And you guys would be able to add more if clients are ready for that. But if you can structure your pitches and your proposals around that, then you can structure your FTE model and your approval process and the costs. You know, what was commoditized before now is bringing down the cost of video to this vertical video CapCut editing style, right? And all this stuff. But soon that's going to get disrupted as well, to your point about...
True. I think something that's also going to come is the next new age media model is going to come from a creator, right? At the end of the day, people who are in the business of creation perhaps know what works better than someone who is just sort of indulged in the business of agency creation. Coming to this point about being a creator, Upton, I'm pretty sure at some point of time, diversifying your image as a person, right, as a content creator, and trying to build a business which is perhaps independent or perhaps taking that content creator to the next level and separating yourself from that business. Was that a challenge that you faced at any point of time?
It's very important for every creator to do that. Even ones with 30, 40, 50 million followers are doing it, because the truth is, when it comes to ad rates and brand deals, they're very volatile. You know, they can be incredible 1 month or one quarter, and then they go quiet, and then, you know, so it's actually very nerve-wracking to just rely on that. So I always call it the third bucket. So as a creator, your first bucket is ad revenue. You can get paid by Facebook and YouTube, and in my case, TikTok, because I have a US account. The second bucket is brand deals. And then the third bucket is kind of a, you know, everyone needs. So a lot of people are going to sell merchandise. A lot of people are going to sell courses. For me, my main third bucket is a B2B agency where we take on clients and we do UGC content for them. So we're not an influencer marketing agency. We don't work with influencers. We just provide really effective content for brands. It wasn't actually very hard for me because it came to me organically. A few years ago, I just got a message on LinkedIn by this big company in the US saying, hey, can you do our YouTube videos and be the face of it? So I said, right, I need to hire a scriptwriter, a producer, an editor. And it just kind of snowballed. And then more and more clients started to come to me. I started to like build a company around this. And it really just came to me. I saw what a need that companies have right now to humanize their content. And
right.
Companies, especially like on TikTok and Instagram, they're really bad at that. They're inherently very polished and curated. And what's most effective, we know by now, is humanizing your content. For me, it's been fun. It's been fun to kind of wear the entrepreneur hat and take on clients and do something in addition to my role as a creator and making content. But it's been a fun ride.
Speaking of which, trying to find the next age of creators, how tough is it to find people who can actually take this business forward across different geographies? Because my personal opinion, I think at some point of time, as an agency, we tried to start media business, right? And very soon we realized that it's extremely challenging to scale it up if you do not get the right creators to continue the journey.
Yeah.
How do you navigate that? And what's the sense of, how do you make sense of that aspect of finding those people or perhaps the next potential Uptons?
Upton Media, which is my company name, my agency, we don't actually have a TikTok account. And people think I'm crazy. They're like, you're in the business of selling TikToks and you don't even have a TikTok account. It's like, well, because we're B2B. We're a B2B agency. And I'll be the first one to meet someone who's maybe interested in our services. And I'll say, no, you don't need our services. You don't need to be on TikTok. You probably need to be on LinkedIn. You need to spend your money elsewhere, right? So, you know, I see what you're saying. And a lot of companies will start their own TikTok or their own Instagram, but they're just not willing to invest long-term in it. Like, and when I say long-term, I mean 1 year of consistent content, minimum 3 posts per week, minimum. So if you're not willing to do that, and if you're not willing to pretty much assign someone on your team or go to an agency to do that, forget it. You're better off not to have that account at all. Right. Because potential clients are going to look at it and say you're inactive or your views are bad or you just have low followers, right? Mm-hmm. I think that it goes back to just kind of having a broader perspective on like what your goals are as a business. And then when it comes to us, we find creators. We usually look for creators between 1,000 and 50,000 followers. Anything more than 50,000 followers, you're really in that influencer territory. You're going to be more expensive. Your time is more valuable, right? But if you have between 1 to 50,000 followers, to me, you've shown me that you know how to make a video, you know how to talk on camera, you know how to capture somewhat of an audience, and you're in that pre-growth stage where we want to work with you. Brands are excited to have you as their face. But again, you're not in that influencer category where you're kind of out of reach for DTC content.
I've seen GovBuzz has a very categorized website, right? There are multiple sections. You put it in extremely meticulously. There are the meticulous sections and then there are bizarre news, right? Why is there a bizarre news section in your website? And if you can give some idea of what's the kind of traffic that you get in bizarre versus non-bizarre.
So a bizarre is one of our highest performing sections, maybe because it's because of the name as well. As you said, it's not your traditional news. It's not to do anything around the UAE. It's not to do anything around the Middle East, but it's anything that's really crazy that's happened around the globe or that's pretty much going viral, as simple as maybe a coffee drink brand that, you know, some creators are trying and they've come out with a hack, which everybody's talking about. That's where we categorize that into that section because that's where people want to read more and that's how.
What's the difference, let's say, of a bizarre post on the website, social media versus a fairly regular reactive piece of news?
As I said, something that goes really viral or something that has really like, for example, someone's jumping off the plane off a window, has opened the door and just right. to get fresh air. That's something comes into for
that
us.
That doesn't happen in Dubai very much.
Yeah. But the other section of the website is basically things to do in the UAE or, you know, where to party, where to eat, where to dine. That's a day-to-day basis. Got what's it. New? New, it doesn't come into bizarre. New is new.
Yeah.
But that's local again.
So is there a percentage of change in terms of the virality level of a bizarre section?
The bizarre section, it depends on what we are writing. But I think our local section is much more higher than the bizarre section. Okay. For sure. Yeah.
Come to someone who's perfected the art of the bizarre section, Richard. The city is a muse for love in Dubai, isn't it? I found something interesting on the website that there are no real sections. You see a request for a cute little kitten being adopted right next to a very strategic government news on jobs being created. Two separate pieces right next to each other jostling for attention. How did that come about? Was it by chance or was it by design? And what's the thought behind that?
TV companies saw the internet, they set up websites, right? And if you see any TV channel around the world, never in their 30, 40 year history did they have writers. Suddenly, they needed to because they had a website because they didn't know how to do video online.
Right.
They started writing articles. So you can understand different things that happen. When newspapers saw the internet, they did business, sports, classic. They just did this same section of the newspaper on the internet. And no one really thought about the design of the website. And then, so we're a social first. So we retrofit it, right? But I think what's happening now is modern media brands in the US who are text first, our newsletter, Hook, Axios, Semaphore, right? They all have links to every article, but it's primary engaged media. It's post-cookie, right? And it's in the inbox. I shouldn't say this really, right? But I'm waiting to pull the plug on our website. I'm ready to like literally unplug our website. Because I don't see it in a modern media world. Like,
right.
I see it secondary after newsletters, but I don't see the role of a website. And I've got developers. I've done a redesign. I've 22 loving websites across the region.
Absolutely.
All plugging into one domain, but all separate backends. And I just don't see it as a, you know, Vice.com shut down their website yesterday. They're social first in distribution.
Right.
Talking about breaking things and disruptive. But like, you know, you still see legacy media companies, and I believe in them. I believe in the IP of legacy media company, like, you know, a Vogue or a GQ. And I do think that sometimes it is worth having print. So sometimes it is worth having a website, but you need to understand that if you know it's just for show and you're not chasing page views, We killed our page views growth as a metric in 2018. We stopped internally chasing page views in 2018. That's why we were so fast onto, as soon as that share button came on Instagram in about 2019, 2020, that's all when it came. Yeah. There was no share button. There was no news in the Instagram feed before then because news didn't get likes, right? Yeah. So the share button was 2012 to 2018 on Facebook. That's where news was.
Yeah.
But that button into our stories, that's a relatively new feature. You really have to understand the product and the consumption behavior to make these decisions. So going back to it though, like essentially like Lovin is a local news and lifestyle platform. We have a Lovin Life like as a mantra. And it's community-based, and people send us these bizarre videos, yeah. And they just get showed up in any category whatsoever.
But then I get a lot of people saying that website is important because that's your base. What if tomorrow it shuts down? Like Instagram goes away. What do we do then?
I totally agree. But like you have to understand, like that's just like saying, hey, I remember, you know, remember in the early days of Lovin, I remember there was a... When I came to Dubai first, I was in a big office in Business Central Towers, and I asked people, where will I get lunch? And people told me the best salad in Dubai is Richie's Salads, right?
Right.
And in 2015, the good entrepreneurs in the restaurant behind Richie's came to Astrolabs, well, 2016, when we had Love in Dubai, and they told me they are refusing to go on delivery apps. They will not go on delivery apps, right? When's the last time you've ordered a Richie's Salads? Do you know what I mean? They were market leaders. They were dominant. Everyone in business in Dubai ordered them in 2012. Trust me.
Yeah.
And now it's every delivery. You know what I mean? I think you have to have a relationship with the internet that you understand the economics behind
it.
I totally agree with first party. I agree with apps and newsletters and everything like that. Yeah. You just have to understand that people aren't going to websites in the way they are before.
True.
And the smart business media podcast in the US. People say, oh, the role of the website now isn't about the article. We need to redesign the homepage. Waste of money. Stop thinking that because the article link isn't the one being clicked of, and because even though they mess up Bard, Gemini, whatever they're going to call it next, because Google are messing up their AI thing big time,
yeah.
It doesn't mean that like the search engine's changing. There's an app called Perplexity, which is like what ChatGPT-4 should do, connected to internet.
Should index back to the website.
It's incredible. Yeah, like when I see that, like I go, yeah, you know, game over. Like for news people trying to drive traffic, stop being precious to it.
Correct.
Build brand, build IP. You ask, you know, it's a bit of a flex, but if you ask people on the street, they're going to know what Lovin Dubai is.
Yeah.
So that's the ultimate benchmark, right? And I made a mistake when I launched Smashy. I called it a streaming service. It's not a streaming service. It's a content platform. I never call Lovin Dubai a website. People call it a page. I don't call it a page.
Do not name it on the platform, but actually call the brand what it is.
People call it an Instagram page, but I spend my time thinking about what content stories, and like Upton's saying, for telling their brands, it's really about the story and what your voice is. And it's not necessarily vanity metrics like page views or followers. Absolutely. You know?
So is it fair to say that ad revenue from the website is a very low part of the business if you're that excited to unplug it?
You're very low and always was. But it depends on what you mean by that. So we have a merch section on the website. Like we have three buckets like you do as well, like an audience bucket, which used to be display and then programmatic and affiliate. Yeah. I call audience, I extend it to what you do. So YouTube and Snapchat. So anything that happens, if you get viral content, either on your platform or someone else's, that you have ad tech and you've header bidding, or you have partnership with Discover section on. So that's one bucket of the revenue. Second bucket is 70-80% always was our branded content. Yeah. So going back to the point about brands being, you know, our pitch that is that brands shouldn't work with agencies. They should hire the Love in Dubai creators because we guarantee them the views. So for the same price of your retainer a month, right, you can get 150,000 video views plus the Love in Dubai host.
Yeah.
Like Farah was at an event this morning doing that, you know, 4-hour takeover with 50,000 guaranteed impressions. So that's our piece. And and they get that for 5, 10, 15,000 dirhams. And they get the cut through to a high affluence audience in the city.
So an alternate view to that, Richard, when a lot of, so the agency business in itself is very multifaceted. You have media companies trying to build agencies just like you guys, the content creators who are trying to sort of build point solutions for brands. One thing that I feel as an alternate view as an agency is, traditionally as an agency, is the fact that while there's a lot of interesting content which can be built by media companies, perhaps even better than agencies, eventually there needs to be a sort of a brand journey which needs to be centralized. You need to have someone who's kind of has a view or has a pavilion view of what a brand should be, with all these diverse pieces of content coming in from different sort of media sources. And it cannot be the brand custodian who is from the brand itself, because you still need that bridge to actually build a pipe between what the brand's doing internally to build its equity and these creators. Otherwise, what's going to happen is these sort of disparate pieces of content, which would not all add up to the larger brand objective. And I think that's where an agency should play a role. I think gone are the times when agencies should say, I'm going to create the content, I'm going to know the brand, I'm also going to come back and do your digital media. I think essentially we become curators. We become curators, creators are the artists, and we're happy whatever you guys want to fill the canvas with, but it all needs to look like it's one single brand.
I agree.
In my opinion, there can be a collaboration instead of the competition to sort of build these models. And that's in sort of a long-term sense, that's the relevancy that we need to build with this sort of a combined.
Effectively, like the principles, it's funny, all these things change with AI.
True,
platforms.
Absolutely. Yes, yes.
But the
perhaps all of us are going to be rendered pointless at one point in time.
And people talk about the education system, right?
Yeah.
But the principles of subjects in university degrees still remains true, right? Like you could still get a marketing degree and be relevant in a modern world. You can still get a journalism degree and understand the ethics of journalism, how to tell stories, right?
True.
And I think, you know, this conversation is kind of halfway between what marketing agencies should do and what modern media publishing companies should do. And, you know, it's almost as if there's a big overlap and it's like winner takes all, but actually not necessarily.
Exactly.
Right? Like, I think that was your point that, you know, marketers can do marketing in this modern world and journalists and content creators can tell stories, you know?
Yeah.
And they can work together.
Both can coexist. And I think one thing which I always tell people, because everyone's about the fact that what's generative AI going to do to us? Is it going to keep us or is it going to enrich us? I think the real bottleneck or the real question to solve is more about what's the workflow you're going to adopt, more than what's the technology that you're going to adopt. Because technology is a commodity right now. I mean, you find a new LLM coming on a daily basis with much more sort of training to it. But how are you going to build that workflow which is actually going to add the value which didn't exist earlier? So in that kind of a world, how does, when things move away from search to conversations, right? How do you see media models being relevant at that point of time? And as you rightly said, I think website is something that could perhaps not be a part of that mix. But in the future, when I have to see what are those things which would become more and more part of that mix which don't exist today, what would that be from a conversational behavior, which is going to be more and more prevalent than a search behavior which exists right now, Upton?
At the heart of content is stories, right? And stories have been around before language. So AI is coming. AI is going to change a lot of things. But at the end of the day, it's going to be like whoever can tell the best, most engaging stories that are going to win. And one thing, again, one shift we've seen a lot the past couple of years is the human led, the human face. You know, we're seeing the woman on TikTok right now who has, I think, like a 60-part series of videos where she's talking about her divorce. I mean, it's just absolutely insane how much buzz and marketing and viral that's going on TikTok. And this is because she's just a good storyteller. You know, she's getting millions and millions and millions of views. And it's a 60-part series. I mean, everyone is just talking about that right now in the marketing world on TikTok. It's like, this woman did everything that TikTok told us not to do, which is like, talk slowly, talk, you know, without any music, no subtitles, no animations, no B-roll, right? And it's absolutely like it's a massive phenomenon. And if you look at why, it's because of her story. So I think when it comes to AI, it's going to be all about using AI to tell better stories, whatever that looks like, whether it's, you know, the B-roll, whether it's the scripts, whether it's a mix of everything, whether it's replacing faces, which we're going to see sooner than we probably think. That's going to be how we can like leverage it.
I agree with Upton in that matter. Like, it still remains with AI, the human touch, because even when you like put things on AI, it's very clear it's done by AI in today's world. But then when you add that human element to that human touch and those faces, and that's when you go viral. And I think that's where people want to see in today's day and age. They're very quick in understanding. This is an ad, like as you were saying, polished ads, you know, agencies and media platforms coming together. That's where I feel there's a blend. Like agencies can do the human touch as well as the polished ad. But when it comes to media and creators, it completely has to be, you know, raw and authentic. Because like today, if I'm going to put up an ad, people know this is an ad, they're going to skip. But the minute one of our creators go on camera and they talk, the watch time is higher.
Absolutely.
And the shares are higher.
Yeah.
That's when we realize, okay, this is working.
When you're creating daily content, you know, and this is for you, because I think there is this constant pressure to create content which performs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
How does someone find purpose and control in that environment? Because you're working with third-party platforms.
They
have their own agenda,
yeah,
/ algorithms.
Yeah.
How do you create a business or a moat which is independent of those platforms?
We have a different strategy for every platform. One, when brands come to us, that's where we feel there's a lot of back and forth, because sometimes brands come with their own set of agendas. They come like, oh, we want this, 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 but we want it in this way. And then we need to get back to them with a script and be like, listen, this is what is going to work and this is not going to work. So if you want to work with us, come do the section that we're telling you. We're happy to do that, but we're not going to commit on anything.
Right.
Because we know it will not work. But if it works, it's your luck. That's what we say. It's luck. Then it's on the algorithms that, you know, it's done its job.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't work, do not come to us.
Right.
And the constant, you know, brainstorming sessions in the office every week on Monday morning, that's what we do. We do not have shoots planned on the first half of the day. Everybody needs to be in the office. Everybody needs to brainstorm. Everybody needs to see what they're doing and how to get better. And that's how we probably come up with ideas.
So for people watching this, Richard, if there's a young kid today who wants to build a Love in Dubai, right? And
like once you're a fellow joke. he's already doing it. Yeah.
Exactly. Perhaps he's already or she's already doing it.
Yeah.
Break it down for him or her. How would you build a Love in Dubai in 2024? Would it be different?
Yeah, it's interesting. I really like I was actually taking notes, some of the AI conversations, some of the chat, and I think it's fascinating. But just to add one little thing on that is media people in the past, the ones that adopted new technologies are the ones that, lasted.
Right.
When we think of like color in movies or Walt Disney and animation and different things, right? And those things were equally relatively as disruptive at the time. So I think... I'm afraid of AI, like I'll admit it, but like I'm also excited by it and I'm leaning towards embracing it in every way. And I have that anxiety that I really want to learn about it, but also put it into context. There is a bit of a bubble, like the NVIDIA price is a bubble, right? We shouldn't go blah, blah, blah. Like this, it will get higher, but like it's a bit of a, you know, there's those things. So AI is fascinating, but going back to, you know, I think your question is interesting in this conversation in terms of brand, right? Why did I think that Love in Dubai had a chance? Because of the brand and because of the era that it launched. The era it launched was at the tail end of blogging, right?
Correct.
And people were still setting up like My Dubai Diary or this or that. And what's happening now is we're on a podcast. This is about the 30th podcast I've done in the last week. No, but like, do you know what I mean? Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, every friend who's going through a job is like, hey, I've started a podcast and podcast studios are commoditized. They're 300 dirham an hour, like it's an RSS feed. It's the open web. It's incredible. Right. But it reminds me of blogging. And then something happened that blogging became Instagram and blogging died. Right. And now what will happen? Audio and content. So, but the blog, and I think you kind of alluded to modern media companies, the era of podcasting was supposed to be the serial scripted storytelling, Gimlet Media, Wondery. It was supposed to be the networks. They all didn't work.
Right.
What worked was this conversation style and build a media company around you. Look at the top 10 podcasts in the US, Huberman, Rogan, all these people, right? And then in the middle of them, there's a crime podcast. But that's it. They're the two categories. It's one or the other. But look at the feeds, right? The feed of the podcast app is very different to the feed of the streaming app, the video streaming app.
Right.
What's the key difference between Spotify and Netflix and Apple and Shahid? What's the key difference? If you release something on Netflix, if you release the 10th episode of Al Arabi School for Girls, it comes last. You release the 10th episode on a podcast, it comes top. So podcast apps are designed for nonfiction, 10 series of the divorce as she's going through it, like TikTok.
And being current.
Yeah. But scripted content is designed for a different environment.
Right.
So until there's an audio app for people like us, like Anas Bukash or Diary CEO, why do they have 21 employees on LinkedIn? And both of them, Anas used to have an influencer agency. Stephen Bartlett used to have a social chain agency in Manchester. They both now run media companies, right? And those, so that's what I would do. I would look at these trends. I would go, what's the name? And always when you're picking something, you have to look at the cohort. We didn't really get lucky, but like, guys, you described it as you used the nice word, not canvas. What did you say, Dubai, is
as a canvas.
I think you said something else, but it was like a canvas.
Creators,
yeah,
on canvas,
yeah,
with artists.
You said Dubai was our muse, right?
Yes.
So, and I think that's fascinating, right? Because media lens is built on the back of a cohort, right? There's a newsletter in the US that has 6 million subscribers. It's a business bullet point newsletter that doesn't write original content. Why? Because there are 30 million daily traders on Robinhood who don't go to the Wall Street Journal to get their NVIDIA stock.
There is an impending need.
Yeah. So if you pick, and there's a city that's growing in population, so all we did was provide a branded content around the city that the world is fixated with. Mm. And if you can do that, and we did that in a blogging clickbait Facebook era.
Correct.
And what we need to do is adapt to the next one. So we need a podcast that works. We need to see where the consumption is, whether it's headsets.
Yeah.
But the muse and the cohort and the behavior is local and is Dubai, but it could be ethnic, it could be gender, it could be female football, Saudi football. If you go, okay, when you say who's going to be the creator who does the next Love in Dubai, well, what is next Love in Dubai?
Hmm.
Is it the Saudi Pro League? Okay, if I decide that I want to create the Love in Dubai for the Saudi Pro League, what do I do? Right? And what are the decisions I make around, you know?
So taking on that, like, let's get a little specific. So you're saying, let's say Saudi football, that's a great passion point for a media business. What would, let's say, 2-3 other passion points be, which would sort of create the case for building that media company?
Passion point is a lens, right?
Right.
So food, passions are a lens, right? Location is a lens, gender is a lens, sport, like there's different things. Look at media, right? Like I think what's underserved, right? I think Arab media is underserved. Muslim, Islam media, Islamophobia is a real thing. I think that's underserved.
Right.
We want to weave that into our narratives. Like The Guardian, if you read The Guardian now versus 10 years ago, or BBC,
yeah,
it's all about females. Like every story is females. But they didn't, they're 150 years old or 200 years old. They didn't change what they were. They just changed the editor. Do you know what I mean? So you can change the content that you serve into things sometimes as well, which is what we're doing at Love in Dubai. We will upweight the human stories on certain topics, like we're doing on the genocide at the moment. We're upweighting the content around these things to tell these stories. But you can then also create a platform that's just focusing on females or the Saudi Pro League, RRR.
Got it. And sort of then perhaps combine that with an integrated programmatic network or something for the brands across different communities. Would that make sense? That's an agency man talking right now.
No, and that's a good point, but like, where are we going with all that tech? Like, I think it's one to figure out.
Right.
CTV is interesting. Programmatic's obviously going up, but you do need people to be on websites.
You need real content.
Yeah.
You need communities to sort of serve.
Or apps, yeah.
Apps, yeah.
But I want to add on both of you, like, as you said, for the new generation to come in, and what do they do need for them to build? If we take examples of only digital platforms, there were so many digital platforms who were Facebook oriented and did not adapt to the Instagram strategy, or when it moved, they died down. Yeah. So probably you just need to adapt to every new tech, every new social platform that is coming. And if it is right for you, need to test and try. Absolutely. I mean, Threads came on board and then the app is somewhere there, somewhere not.
They're trying so hard.
They're trying so hard.
Their growth hacking tactics.
I mean, the first 1 week, I think all of us were on Threads. Everyone was trying to, you know, jump on it and try to monetize it from day one because we were getting followers.
Yeah.
But then I think after a week and a half, we all realized it's not going anywhere.
I think it's unpopular opinion. Threads will make it. I mean, this is me, but because I think in the long run, people said the same thing about Reels. At one point of time, right? Like at the end of the day, they probably thought that they tried Reels
for
the world. It didn't work. kept trying.
IGTV was its own app.
Yeah. IGTV was its own app, absolutely. It didn't work.
And it got moved into video and then Reels.
But then what's the real alternative to Threads? It's X, all right?
I think the alternative to Threads is Instagram, right?
Well, yeah.
Your example with people resisted Reels, but that's because they were used to seeing their friends' photos and their photos, right? And they're like, who are all these videos from random people that are very addicting coming from? But it works, right? Clearly, Reels won that debate. I think X and Twitter use was already, before Elon Musk, was very questionable. I mean, because we moved from print and text to video, to photos, then video. So to me, like, you know, I started across all platforms really hard in 2020, 2021. And Twitter at the time was kind of the most lackluster of all platforms. And what is the purpose that Twitter or now Threads serves is instant real-time news. But guess what? Now we get that on Instagram. We get that through Smashy or through Love in Dubai, you know, through an image post. That's how I get a lot of my news first thing when I wake up. You know, you can get it, as Richard said, sharing stories, which is relatively new.
Yeah.
It's a good point. I do think that Upton, though, that the algorithm is removing the date now on Instagram. Yeah. So I'm wondering, where will people get that news from? I do think that Threads is a feature, not a product. I think, you know, it should just have a little section there. Mm-hmm. You know what's really interesting, though? The bottom left-hand corner of WhatsApp,
yeah,
that's now the channels and the subscriptions
right,
and things.
Right.
And, you know, I think these companies, you have to look at the leaders, right? Like, and Zuckerberg stopped his metaverse billion-dollar obsession things. And he went back to growth hacking and doing product features and this stuff. And I've heard anecdotally from some agencies, the roadshows that Meta salespeople are doing at the moment, and maybe they've come to you guys, it's Threads.
Yep.
And it's WhatsApp for business.
Correct.
Instagram sells itself. They're not talking about it.
Absolutely.
So when you've got a well-run company that's super profitable, pouring tons of billions of dollars into Threads and WhatsApp business, something's got to happen.
That's the point. I mean, at the end of the day, it is that one single sort of focus, which would perhaps still keep the text-based broadcast alive as much as visual broadcast, because there needs to be an alternative. I feel as much as we love interacting with each other on video, there are still areas which would perhaps not be second nature to video. There would be things which would still perhaps be more natural to a text-based interface. But that's a discussion. That's an evolving discussion. Upton, for you, I've seen one of my favorite videos of yours is the California crime crisis, right? And I think it's something which is done well for you. How do you sort of navigate between doing videos as a content creator, which may be seen as politically sensitive?
At the end of the day, I report on things that are usually already out there, but I'm just kind of giving color and light to them. So for instance, when I went to Qatar before the World Cup, I did a video, is Qatar ready for the World Cup? And I looked at, you know, I interviewed people, I interviewed fans, I interviewed people working on the stadiums. And of course, I mentioned that there were, you know, thousands of deaths in building those stadiums, which is, you know, you could see that's political or controversial, but it's just a fact. Right. And actually somebody, multiple people wrote in the comments like, ooh, good luck coming back to Qatar, you're going to be banned and stuff. And, you know, 6 months later, I was actually doing a collab with Qatar's tourism board. So my goal is not to create enemies, but my goal is to, you know, to be truthful as well. Like when I do reporting and stuff, same thing when I cover Saudi, when I cover a lot of places, it's like, there are things that are out there that are well known. It's a simple Google search, and I'm going to include that. Because I would be doing injustice if I wasn't. I'm not here to just, you know, to like promote a company or a country. I'm here to, like, you know, my passion is really doing that reporting and going to different places and going and really discovering the unique side of a story.
Right.
So for me, I never let that kind of fear overrun my, like, oh, well, what if I won't, you know, they want to do a brand deal with me or any of that. It's like, I have to kind of, you know, be truthful. And I think that comes from my journalist background.
That's fairly brave if you have to say that in this part of the world and different parts of the world.
I just add to that, I think it's, media is new in this part of the world. And I think we have a region and we have a chance to reshape what media is. It doesn't have to be linked to a First Amendment written in some parts of the world at the end of the 18th century. It just doesn't have to be, right? Like, and I think, you know, I always bring up these stats because I'm fascinated by it, right? The printing press was banned by the Ottoman Empire for hundreds of years. The first printing press in Egypt was 300-400 years after Gutenberg press in 1820 or so. The first printing press in Riyadh was in 1953. Arab News started in 1975. The UK Times started in 1775, 200 years difference. So I like what Upton is saying, but we have 40 of our 80 employees or 90 employees who create content every day. It is risky. I don't want any of them. I don't want to be a conflict reporter. I don't want any of them to die working for us. Absolutely. And the Al Jazeera at the fire station and during the World Cup in Qatar, they had a museum and they showed the 25 years history of Al Jazeera, a pioneer, innovative, amazing media, technology, everything, like from all the era. And outside, there was a memorial for 11 deaths, and there's more now, and the date of the time that they died. And I looked at that and I said, I don't want this. So when it happened on the 7th of October, we had two journalists working there, and they still not posted since. We pay them every month, but we're doing it from Egypt because I don't want them to be at risk.
Absolutely.
So more so than they already are. Yeah. But we can still, like Upton says, we can still do things. Like, what's fascinating is Saudi just launched their first ever media council of journalists that people were elected. Dubai have a new council. Like, the media that's happening in the region is happening. The printing press is not banned. It's the internet. And the Western world just needs to get used to that. We don't phone hack here, right? Yeah, well, no. Media doesn't. But like, we don't have the... You know, there is stuff that happens in the Western world, in the UK, that isn't okay.
Absolutely.
Right? Media is toxic. People commit suicide based on what media and tabloid have done to them in the past. It's not okay. Paparazzi is not okay. Mm. I prefer it here. But I wouldn't call it brave. I would call it just doing what you're allowed to do.
And sort of coming to this fact that when it comes to media, bias has become like an embedded feature, right? Do you think fundamentally bias is something which is unavoidable, indispensable in media? Or do you think it should be sort of removed from it? And if at all it is to be, is technology going to play to do that?
What do you think, Joe? Are you biased?
We're not biased on Gulf Plus, but I think it's going to take a lot of time to get that out. It is that.
I think it's like clickbait. It's a loaded word. And I don't think it needs to be negative.
Right.
I think if you're passionate about something and you're transparent and you do journalism properly, it's with a well-intended bias, it's okay. Like if Saudi win their first gold medal in Paris this summer, and I write an article that the Saudi sport is doing well, someone negative would say sports washing bias. And someone else is like, yeah, but they just won their first medal. And also like, but I'm the national newspaper and you know, so I think it's dependent. You know, clickbait is a good example. Like propaganda was a word that was changed. Dictator is a word that's changed. If you look at the original words of what they mean, they have negative connotations.
True.
They're not actually negative.
No.
Business can have a negative connotation. It's just business. Yeah, but
capitalism.
Yeah, right. Business can provide food on table and livelihoods, right? Business can take people out of poverty. Yeah. Business is great.
Right.
Done wrong, it's a disaster. It's unethical. There's a story happening right now about a fraud case in Dubai that my investigative journalist is WhatsApping me about. I'm worried about it. So business can be bad, right?
Yeah.
But I think we're intentionally biased. We're intentionally pro the city that we're from.
Hmm.
I want the journalists that I hire in Baghdad to show me the best of that city.
Yeah. And
when Upton is going to these places, I love what he's doing. It's pure, it's journalism, but he's showing, it is a bit biased. He is actually showing the positive side because he's not going in with like, when Vice came here 20 years ago and just going for that negative story because I was going to say sex sells, but because like if it bleeds, it leads.
Mm. Correct.
And if it bleeds, it doesn't lead anymore.
Yeah.
Really, honestly, if it bleeds, it doesn't lead on Instagram.
Really? Do you think so?
Yeah, I do. I really do because it can get some traction, but it gets covered and it gets hate speech and it upsets people.
Hmm.
And actually, positive and emotion stories can do as well as the bleed stuff can work.
Yeah.
But if you, the front page of the Sun newspaper, the bleed stuff is different on social media. I really think that.
And I think when you look at the data, when you, let's say, eventually the revenue is perhaps coming from brands. Is that a right assessment? Eventually, the revenue is going to come from brands. And when we go and talk to the brands from a media perspective, it's always going to be about traffic. Going to be about engagement. No one's going to go to the brand and say, hey, here's the positive sentiment and here's the negative sentiment. So it's always going to still come down to those vanity metrics when we put up our, let's say, media rate cards. Is that a correct assessment? Or will there be a time when we actually go to them and say, hey, I've got the best positive sentiment in my media channel, as a result, invest in my media channel. Is that something that, because that's my sort of a alternate point to when it leads, because at the end of the day, it does lead when it comes to the money's coming in. Is that a correct assessment? What do you guys
think? I think when it comes to bias, consumers want a little bias. And that's evident even back in cable news, right? If you look at what happened, why did Fox News become the biggest cable network in the US and MSNBC become number two and CNN, which historically before Trump just gave the facts, it's because they had slant, they had bias. And that's because of the internet, right? Before internet, you would go to news networks to consume the news, to get the headlines. But then you got your headlines via notifications all day long. So if you're going to sit, you know, open your TV and watch a program, you want to know, yes, and this happened, and why does it matter? And that's where bias comes in. I think it's all about kind of owning that bias. So same thing, MSNBC is like, hey, we're a left-leaning network. Fox News is the opposite. And so same thing for creators, for multimedia brands. It's all about like positioning themselves as like, this is what we believe, and we're going to talk about facts and stuff through this lens. I think most of the content we all consume is biased, whether it's an entrepreneur, whether it's politics, it is biased. For me, you know, am I biased? Am I not? Who knows? Depends on the story, right? But I mean, yeah, I'll admit it's impossible for any journalist to not have some bias, right? It's absolutely impossible, whether it's a word choice on a subconscious level. But for me, my goal, and I think as a trained journalist, I do this, is to say, you know, a lot of people believe this, but a lot of other people believe that. And my goal is to let you decide. Now, some things where I go to in Iraq or something like that, I'm going to absolutely do a recap video on like, holy hell, like this is what I think about this.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But I also am not here to like, to, you know, create, I genuinely don't go to any country with an agenda, any country, because it just doesn't serve me. And I think I was trained at CNBC for years. Anytime I would file a story, the editor would say, yeah, but we need another quote on the other side, right? Mm-hmm. And if I've done that for enough years, yeah, it's impossible to unlearn.
So, of course, a whole different intense discussion on the fact that we all know that it exists. It's just about, is it big enough to solve as we go ahead? But I think that's a fairly loaded, larger conversation in that sense, right?
I think companies like the BBC spend their whole time trying to be impartial, and they're funded by the taxpayer.
Exactly.
But if they, as Upton kind of said, if they own what their position is, you know, if they own, like The Guardian is owning that they think that the voice of the woman is underrepresented in a modern British society, and they're probably right.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And I think you can do good through what you do. And I think bias doesn't need to be negative.
Yeah.
But going back to the measurement question, like, you know, I think brands sometimes don't want to be around unsafe content. So there's a bit of, you know, brands will pick influencers that they feel that represent their voice and isn't going to say something silly and people get canceled.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, the metrics and the ways of measuring, luckily I'm not doing agency work, but like, you know, I don't have, but KPIs are such a big thing and they dictate budget. Like, is it lead bends? Is it performance marketing? And what are the metrics, right? What is it about growth and things like that? You know, ultimately, I think it's bigger than any piece of an influencer post or a paid media branded partnership. I think your marketing metrics have to be related to your business goals, and you have to understand everything internally.
100%. There must have been at some point of time when you started doing content in different capacities, when that one piece of viral content actually decided that, hey, this is what I want to do. Do you think luck plays an essential role?
I do still believe that luck does play an important role, but hard work and having your niche and you know what you want to do, what kind of stories you want to say, definitely plays a higher role. But as simple as TikTok, my first video went viral.
Overnight. What was it about?
It was just one big Sunday coming onto my table. It had my face. It didn't have a GulfBuzz name because at that point of time, I didn't have a GulfBuzz TikTok page. I just posted it. And
a big what?
A big Sunday. It was like,
oh, yeah,
this huge Sunday. It's just coming. And just like, I'm just sitting with my camera. I just came in and just put it. I didn't know how to use TikTok. I put it up, blew up. Overnight, I had like 2,000 followers. And I was like, damn. At certain places, yes, I feel luck does work. But what I have realized that it's not only luck. It's also like, you know, how do you take that forward after that point of time? Right. Is when you plan, what do you want to do? What your niche is? What do you expertise in? How do you want to be different than others in telling stories. It's as simple as, like, it's been 2.5 years now. I've changed my way of doing videos 3 times, whether it be texting, whether it be music. We've changed it 3 times. Why? Because we've seen more people adapting to it. So, and we want to be a little different than others. You have something.
Well, I was going to say, if we want to get technical, I believe there is no luck in content.
Yeah.
Richard and I were in Vegas at the same time. And if you walk into one of those casinos, you know, that is pure luck. It's completely random, right? When it comes to content,
we were there for CES. We weren't there.
Sure, sure. Thank you.
That was my next
massive tech conference. But when you think about content, ultimately, it comes down to an algorithm, which, you know, makes us feel lucky. But technically, there's data, there's science behind it, which we will never truly understand.
This is a big phenomenon that most creators have. It happens to me every month. I'll do at least a couple of TikToks that get at least 1 million views. If you look at the one before and after that, it has maybe 5,000 or 10,000, right? And if you look at me, maybe I can say why one did extremely better than the other, but oftentimes I can't. And I think that's why we think it's luck, because we just don't truly understand the algorithm. But at the end of the day, you know, the more content you pump out there, the more you start to, like, decipher, and the more the algorithm, of course, the algorithm's changing. Maybe every day, we don't know.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, if it's a good video, people are watching it, people are commenting it, people are sharing it, it will go. And I think one thing that we can verify is, like, you will never have a video that has 1 or 2 million views with very few comments or very few shares, right?
Yeah, so
ultimately, all of these things are feeding each other. And I think you can only get to that point of being a successful creator
if you pump out a lot of quantity to get to the quality.
It's really hard to scale that as well. Like, you know, I've seen lots of people, and, like, Jove, you're trying to do it now, but, like, if you do it and you know you're a creator, it's like the old guys at YouTube, right? When they were, like, editing, they're like, oh, I couldn't hire an editor because they didn't know how to edit in the way that I knew how to grow my page.
How do I transfer?
Really hard. And I think with the algorithms and with formats, it's really hard, because you might be at an event or someone might be listening to this now, right? And there might be something that we said that could go super viral.
Right.
Yeah. But it takes the right edit, the right time, on the right page, with the right algorithm, with the right... If it's a business thing, or if it's a food thing, or if it's a political thing, anything. Yeah. If it's something about a country at a certain time, like if something said about politics, you know, and a good curator, like I love that word, because it's, you know, if a good curator can spot the art and to package it up. Yeah. We have playbooks and we spend all time telling people how to do stuff, but, you know, like I really want to check out that TikTok lady, right? Because I don't know that one, but you know, there are people who know how to do threads on X that goes super viral,
because
they just know how to package it. And there's other people who wrote the same story on a website that no one's on, with 5,000 words, that didn't know how to get the reshares, the retweets, the comments, you know. And it's the same video, it's the same cut, but, like, as modern content creators, whether we're journalists or brands or influencers, you have to understand that, like, the story is one part, but the packaging, the distribution, the native way that you tweak it.
So is that a right assessment when we say that at the end of the day, there's nothing more that you can do but just create and then let the algorithm figure out how to do it and sort of constantly keep optimizing it and seeing what's working, let's do more of it. What's not working, let's not do it.
Gary Vaynerchuk, like, he wrote a book once years ago, like, jib jab, like, just keep punching, keep doing that, right?
Right.
And, like, you can have loads of strategies around stuff, but, like, actually, like, it's kind of leading people down a wasted path, right? Like,
right.
You tell a young person, just, you know, embarrass yourself and do all these dances and you're going to make it. No, like, I think, you know, Upton started the conversation by saying about looking at data and, like, you have to fail fast with this stuff.
Absolutely.
You can't do the same thing over. I've been guilty of it, like, on Smashy and some of the things. We keep doing the same show over again for years and it's not working.
Yeah.
It's not working. So why are we doing this? And you hire journalists to do it and then they don't know that they should be looking at the data.
Yeah.
And they think it's their job to do the thing that was done before.
Yeah. No. I can't do more of what's not working. Yeah. That's the whole.
I think it's a constant test of seeing and seeing your analytics and seeing, like, getting through it, like, just seeing what's working and what's not working. And
then the science of it.
And then move your strategies around it to keep pushing yourself forward. I think that's what we also do.
I think it's a mix. Like, if you want to learn how to bake a cake you've never baked before, you can either, like, go to the store and just buy a bunch of eggs and ingredients that you think are going to work and randomly mix stuff and keep putting it in the oven and see how it turns out. Or you can look up a recipe. Right? So I think that goes to, like, upskilling yourself, even watching content on how to make good videos. You definitely want to do some of that. But you can't just focus on reading recipes all day. You got to eventually start and mix some stuff. So you got to find that balance between training and also execution and practice.
Yes, I agree.
One unpopular opinion about being in the new age media business. If you had to sort of say that one thing, which you think a lot of people wouldn't agree with, but you think that's the absolute axiom in the business, just one thing, if all of you guys can sort of talk about it.
Two opinions in one. That the platforms own us and the algorithms, and we're all servants to the algorithms. And then the second thought is that, like, you know, Western media bias around this region, around events that have been happening.
That's such.
And people come out and go, hey, we need our own platform. But I don't necessarily think that's true. I think we just need our own voices. And, you know, I don't think the platforms totally own us. I just think that that's the way the internet is. And the internet's going to keep evolving, you know? So it's kind of two things in one. Like, you know, why wasn't there why are social media networks big everywhere? Why isn't there one for each region? And then also, like, you know, is the way to counter Western media bias by building our own platforms in the region? I'm obviously Western. Like, I'm an immigrant here, but, like, you know, this is the region that we choose to work in. But, like, I think that my current view on it is that we can build voices in the region that can live like liquid content, like, you know, it can float everywhere.
That's a great point, actually.
What do you think are unpopular opinions? Yeah. Let them count it.
I think it's not for everyone. I think
content.
Yeah. I think people think that with platforms coming in, with the barriers to creation being lesser and much cheaper, everyone thinks that they can sort of start being a content creator and being in a new age media business. It's hard. It's really hard because I think there's so much amount of personal struggles that you need to go through on a daily basis. And at the same time, keep creating content, which is very consistent, the right path. You keep the long-term objective. I've seen that the break-even in new age media could be very tricky, right? Like, in fact, sometimes the break-even in this business could be even higher than a business with huge infrastructure, like an education or a manufacturing business. But people don't realize that when they start doing it. They're just looking at pieces of content. I think so. It's not for everyone. It's for someone who's really passionate about creating engagement rather than looking for brand money. I mean, this is my opinion.
Okay. My unpopular opinion is that data is your frenemy as a creator. You know, my background actually is finance. I'm into numbers. But when it comes to, you know, if you ask me what's your CPM, your RPM, your click-through rate, your average watch time on your latest videos, I couldn't begin to tell you any of that information. And that's why it's unpopular. A lot of, especially like YouTubers and stuff, know all of that by heart. And they're constantly optimizing and strategizing on increasing that by 1%, 10%, 5%. But for me, it ends up sucking out the flow state of creating content. And so if I get too intertwined in that data, then I just end up burning out and not wanting anything to do with storytelling. So I always know, you know, how many views a video got. But beyond that, I kind of limit myself, unless maybe once every 6 months, I'll do a deep dive into some of the numbers.
I think I agree with Upton on the same, because I do the same. I don't dive deep. If it's done well, it's done well. And I think every 6 months or 3 months, I get a report. I sit down and then I'll start and think, okay, where can we do better? I think that's...
So maybe it's not as unpopular.
Yeah.
No, I agree.
Still like a shepherd, though.
All right.
Yeah.
So it's been a pleasure to have all of you guys. I hope it was a good conversation. It was sort of took us all from a point A to point B. And I think one thing that I'm really thankful to all of you is perhaps you've given me the confidence to do more of this, more of these conversations. Have a great weekend. Have a great Saturday.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.